Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We have a special guest in studio today, Mike Letzring, horticulturalist from the San Diego Zoo. Morning, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
Yes, thank you.
The zoo and the wild animal park are huge repositories of collectible plant material here in San Diego.
Yes, for sure.
I have heard it said, maybe you can confirm it or not. And if it's true, I think a lot of people don't realize it, but I've heard that the plant collection at the Zoo and Wild Animal Park is actually worth more than the animals.
Yes, that's been going around ever since I've been there. I've been there for 28 years now.
Oh, wow. Okay. So
but you know, when my wife and I go, and actually years ago with my kids, I spend more time looking at the plants, and I find much more interest, probably because I've seen animals my whole life, but some of the plants you don't typically see. So it is a great venue to see rare and unique plants.
Oh, I know at the wild animal park, I tend to look at the plants more than I do the animals. We were at Melanie and I had gone to the safari park.
Ooh, yes.
Forgot they changed the name. The safari park. We had been there. We were walking around and I think it was during the evening, and Melanie said, you know, we've been here for about an hour and I have yet to see an animal. So you've been there for 28 years. So who was head horticulturalist when you came on?
It was Charles Coburn.
Charles. Okay. I remember Charles. Yeah. Yeah. He took over. I'm trying to remember did he take over after Ernie Chu?
Correct.
Okay. And I remember I met Ernie on a number of occasions too. He was there for a long time as well.
Yes, he was.
So, well, before you go too far down the road of the zoo, I want to know how Mike got into horticulture.
Well, that's true.
And, you know, your background and how you ended up at the zoo doing this.
Well, oh boy. Being born and raised in San Diego, I mean, when I was going to school, I was more interested in oceanography, but for some reason or another, I came to land. Mm-hmm. And basically horticulture was what I fell to, and going to school at Mesa College and just getting a community junior college nursery and landscape degree. And then, you know, what better can you have if you want to live in San Diego as far as a place to work? And it was the San Diego Zoo. So for years I tried getting there. So it's all about learning about collections of plants, and especially palms and tropicals.
Yeah, my grandfather was... He was a huge palm tree fan. I mean, I think that was probably his favorite type of plant was palm trees. He was a member of the International Palm Society for many, many years, and just absolutely loved them. As a matter of fact, I know we've mentioned it on the air before, but as you walk into the entrance of the zoo, you have the flamingo enclosure in front of you, and there's a huge ficus tree on the corner where it used to make the turn to what used to be Monkey Mesa, which I can't remember what the name of that area is.
Yes,
now.
Yes.
But directly across from that ficus tree, there's a giant Senegal date palm, a Phoenix reclinata.
Correct.
Yeah, my grandfather planted that. Moved it. He dug it up out of somebody's yard in Point Loma in the mid-1950s. I think it was 1954, 1955. Hauled it on a truck up to the zoo and put it in there, and it's still there. As a matter of fact, we got pictures of it at Jungle Bells this year. Okay. It was all spectacularly lit up, as I might say.
For those that are only on the radio, they didn't see Ken using his hands to describe all of that, you know, one hand here pointing this way, making signals, but it was all lost.
I remember my dad telling me because my dad was 15, I think, at the time that they did that. And he went with when they moved it, the move from Point Loma to Balboa Park, they had to do it in the middle of the night because of traffic, and they had to coordinate with SDG&E because they had to drop power lines all the way from Point Loma to the tree was so huge. They had to have SDG&E drop power lines so that they could get it through the street. So there was a newspaper article that was written about it at the time. And I can't remember the, I can't remember the woman's name that donated it to the zoo, but it was a it's a beautiful palm tree. Even to this day, we have photographs of my son Blake standing underneath that palm tree that his great grandfather planted.
That's a nice legacy.
In the 1950s, yeah, it's pretty neat. So my grandparents were always patrons of the zoo for my memorable lifetime.
We established on the last show last week that you're 45, right? So
yeah.
So about 45 years.
Yeah. But our family and my parents have carried on with that, and Melanie and I carry on with that too, supporting the zoo mainly for the horticultural side of it.
And so, we appreciate it immensely.
Yeah. So one of the other collections that I've heard at the zoo that is rather large is the Erythrina collection, coral trees.
And yes.
Somebody had said that you guys have one of the best collections of Erythrinas in the country.
Yes. Modeling after Hawaii, where most of the best collections of Erythrina are both at Waimea Valley and National Tropical Botanical Garden in Kauai. We've kind of come third in that line.
Really? Yeah. You know, it's funny. I've been to Waimea Valley a number of times when I've been over there. It's a beautiful garden. The gardens up there are gorgeous. If you're ever on the North Shore and have a chance to go over and see it, I highly recommend it. I don't remember seeing any Erythrinas there when I was there.
Yeah, most of the Erythrina collection in Waimea Valley is in the back 40,
okay,
sort of in the back area. And they've definitely introduced more to the front where most of the public will see them now. But it's about half of the collection is in the back.
I guess I need to go back there and take a look.
Where was the one in Kauai?
At National Tropical Botanical Garden.
I don't think I've ever been there. I've only been to Kauai once, and I don't remember going there. You know, I know you do a lot of work in Hawaii. How did you get involved with the work that you're doing in Hawaii?
It had to do with the Erythrina collection.
Oh, really?
And it was in 1998. Mm-hmm. We got a whole bunch of cuttings from David Orr, who is the botanical specialist in Waimea Valley. And obviously our collection was known from him as well. So he sent us a bunch of pencil thick size cuttings, and well, that's how it started. And I was just a lead horticulturist at the time. And so we tried to propagate those and get those going, but most of them failed. And so mm-hmm. then I said to Mike Bostwick, who was the horticulturist at the time,
okay,
is it okay if I go over there and help them and then try to get this collection back over here again?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it started.
That's interesting.
So now you go there a couple times a year.
Yeah, now I'm there three times a year.
Uh-huh. And you're big into palms?
Yes, palms have always been my first love for plants when I got involved in horticulture. And right now I'm especially involved with the Hawaiian palms, the Brochardia family.
Yeah, you were, correct me if I'm wrong, aren't they the true native ones are threatened at this point?
Yeah, unfortunately, with the conditions that they have because of a coconut rhinoceros beetle. Yeah, coconut rhinoceros beetle. It used to be that they were just after the coconut palms themselves. And mm-hmm. then about 2012 and 13, or maybe a little later, they started going after the native Brochardias. There are 26 species native to the Hawaiian Islands.
I didn't realize there was that many. It sounds like the rhinoceros beetles, the similar threat to the
South American palm
weevils.
Palm weevil that we're dealing with over here, which we were talking to an arborist a couple of months ago that we had on the show, and he was saying that they have actually started spreading out away from Phoenix canariensis, and they're finding them in Phoenix dactyliferas, some reclinatas. I think he even said that they had evidence of them in queen palms.
And I think there was one co-worker of his that mentioned, not co-worker, another arborist that mentioned that they found it in a Phoenix robellini, so the pygmy gate palms as well.
Yeah, it's crossed over into the Brahia palm family, and also Brochardias as well. Yeah. As far as Bismarckia palm, we've had a few of those.
Wow. Have you had problems controlling it at the zoo at this point?
This year and the last year, I think we started getting better, and it seemed like things are starting to mellow out a little. I mean, obviously the weevils are still around, mm-hmm. but we were able to use some control.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been mostly just trying to keep the culture of the palms healthy with plenty of water and nutrition. And that's just my opinion, that I've been able to keep palms healthier if we can keep that going.
I would argue that that's pretty much everything, right? If you take care of them,
The healthier the plant, the stronger it is. You mentioned being able to use controls on it. I can't imagine that the palm collection is used that much for foraging for the animals, but a lot of the plants that you grow at the zoo, you do use for feeding the animals.
Correct.
Yeah. Right. So you have to be very careful with what's going into their diet.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, for the palms, the thing that we have to be concerned with is the bee, the honeybee.
Okay.
And when the palms go into flowers. So obviously we don't want to have that issue. So we either will bag the flowers or take them out so that we don't have flowers if we are to treat the palm.
Talk a little bit about what you are doing in Hawaii with the Prechardias.
So with the Prechardias, we have a permit now from the state of Hawaii and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And with those, we started with the island of Oahu. And those four species that are native to there are now with us here at the San Diego Zoo as a backup.
Okay.
So in case the CRB or the coconut rhinoceros beetle does get more than it should, and then we should hopefully have a backup for that collection here at the zoo. And then at some point we'll plant them in the zoo when they get of size. And then, you know, if it comes worse to worse, we might be the only place for those palms left so they can be reintroduced at some point.
Kind of like a seed bank then.
Correct.
Yeah.
What are some common names for those palms for people that don't know the botanical?
The Lolu palm.
Okay.
So that's I wouldn't know that one either.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Yeah,
that's the Hawaiian.
I don't know that I've seen that many Prechardias here on the mainland. As a matter of fact, I don't know that I would recognize one going. I'm very familiar with the name, but I don't know that I would recognize one if I saw one in the landscape.
I think the easiest way to describe them is they look a little bit like the Washingtonia, Mexican fan palm, a little bit like the Livistonas, the Australian fan palms, and just take away the spines or the thorns.
Okay.
It's basically armless.
So a fan palm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very interesting. Another popular place at the zoo is the Orchid House. And you guys, that's actually open to the public now a couple of times a month, isn't it?
Every third Friday of the month, we're open. And then quarterly, I think through on a Sunday. So you can check that out on the zoo's website, exactly the dates when they're open on Sundays. But every third Friday of the month, we have Plant Day, along with the Orchid House being open for the public.
I went through the Orchid House a long time ago.
I honestly don't think I've ever been through it.
It's worth seeing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we have over 3,000 plants of orchids in the zoo, most of them in that Orchid House. There's over 982 species.
Wow.
And it's almost, when you think about it and you think of the amount of days that were open for the public to see, basically, you could see a flower of an orchid once every time you come because of how many of those we have in that collection.
We're talking with Mike Letzering from the San Diego Zoo. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. Almost couldn't say my name. if you have a suggestion or a question or somebody that you would like to hear us talk to on the show, please drop us an email at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. And we'd be happy to answer your question on the air. And we will do our best to see who we can bring in to that you would find interesting to listen to. Today, we are talking to Mike Letzering, a horticulturalist at the San Diego Zoo. And we were talking about the orchid collection, how it is open to the public on certain days. Check the website, the San Diego Zoo website, to find out what days it is open. I would recommend that you go and see it, though. It is pretty amazing. One of the plants that we have growing in the store here right now, actually we have two, one of them is really tiny compared to the main one, is the corpse flower. And ours is in a vegetative growth
phase
right now. And I didn't realize this, but you had told us that you have a few of those in the collection at the zoo.
Yes, we do. Since 2011, who our propagator at the time was Christy Powell, who is now my manager, we had 11, and we still have those 11.
Wow.
And one in particular is about the size of yours that you have in the store now. Mm-hmm. So we're waiting for ours to flower for the first time.
Soon.
Yeah. Hopefully. Yeah, we were fortunate. Ours bloomed fairly quickly after we got it. It was only a couple of growth cycles before it flowered. So now I'll be curious to see when it blooms again. I know in the wild, I think they say it blooms every 7 to 10 years or something like that. But as with things in the wild, it's not getting pampered, and it's leading a pretty hard scrabble life out there. So I'm hoping that maybe with some coddling and extra care, if we don't kill it with that it might shorten its blooming cycle and we'll see it flower again sooner.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, you know, up until when yours flowered, I remember trying to figure out why aren't ours flowering, because ours are old enough. But what we found out was, in order for that bulb to flower or get to the flowering stage, it needs to weigh about 20 pounds.
Yeah, that's a big bulb.
And so if you don't put it in a big enough container, which was our problem, we wouldn't get one. So I moved ours up into 24-inch boxes, three of them. And so this year, one of them, like yours that you have in the front of the store, is pretty much what ours is looking like now. So that's the one I'm hoping for.
You know, it's funny that I had read about that plant years and years ago it was either in Tropica or Exotica, because I used to come to the nursery and I'd sit in the office and just sit there and flip through those books and just admire all the plant material from all over the world that was in there.
But you weren't getting any work done.
I wasn't getting any. Well, I was only 12 or 13, so I was learning.
Okay.
But that was where I remember seeing that seeing pictures of it for the first time, and I never thought I would ever see one in person,
let alone have one in your backyard.
And the first time I ever saw one of the actual plants was at the conservatory in Golden Gate Park. They had a huge one there. We were there about 10 or 15 years ago, and we were walking through the conservatory, and they were massive. They were in their vegetative growth state. That was the first time I had ever seen one. And then several years later, we were fortunate enough to acquire one. And then shortly after we got ours, the one at the botanical garden bloomed. And that was the first time on this side of the United States that I had ever heard of one blooming. And John Clements was the horticultural manager at the time, and he got us in to see it, and it was spectacular. It really is an amazing thing.
But
and
now we don't need any of those things. Yeah, we have our own.
we have our own, and it did bloom a couple of years ago, and it really is amazing. I mean, it's the flower on those things, it's just massive. And to think that it gets pushed up out of that, a 20 pound bulb is a big bulb.
Yes.
But when you look at how big that flower is, it's a pretty incredible process.
Well, hopefully yours will do it this year.
Hopefully yours will come around shortly.
Yeah. Our management is looking at three of them that we have and thinking we'll have three. That'll be even a better show if we can get all three to do that.
Well, speaking of shows, you know, one of the things that I think you've been involved with was Africa Rocks, right? When they did that whole remodel of the zoo and you were instrumental in a lot of the plantings. Tell us about that, because that was a huge undertaking.
That was probably the biggest revamping of a section of the zoo that I remember in my lifetime.
Correct. And it was, and it still kind of is. So in 2015, after we started or finished the Elephant Odyssey, we started working on our centennial project, which 2016 is when the zoo turned 100 years old. And so
they don't look a day over 92.
No. And so the idea was, we're going to work on what used to be called Dog and Cat Canyon, and let's transform that into what is now Africa Rocks. So that was a little over 8.5 acres that basically we salvaged, reconfigured, new infrastructure and new everything else, and then basically built Africa Rocks, what you see today.
Now, what's the total acreage of the zoo? I can't remember off the top.
Well, if you count inside the zoo with the fence, it's 100.
Okay.
If you count the parking lot, it's 120.
Yeah, the parking lot is big, very big.
So what are some of the more unique plants that you have in Africa Rocks that you were involved with?
Well, I think the one that probably stands out the most for me, and that everyone has always talked about wanting when you have a theme of Africa, is to have a baobab tree.
Mm-hmm.
So the Adansonias. So we at first were trying to find some large ones, but we knew that was going to be difficult. Obviously, there are certain restrictions with USDA that just didn't allow us to have certain sizes because of the problems, or some of the things we have to do in order to get them. So the largest we could get were three footers, and these were mostly Madagascar baobabs. So that's where it started. It all came from a collector up in Lancaster, California.
Really? That's interesting. Did he grow them from seed?
He grew them from seed, yes.
Oh, wow.
So that takes care of any of the restrictions from USDA?
Yes. So if they're under 3 foot, they kind of mix. So we could have gotten some from Florida, but we decided to take these on instead.
Now, what was the 3 foot limit?
It was just the guideline that was given to us. I mean, I wish I could explain it more, but I can't.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you said out of the whole area that was redone for Africa Rocks, there was one tree that was kept, ficus tree?
Yes, that's right. With 8.5 acres, obviously, we had to salvage quite a few of the trees, and most of them we saved, and then others we repurposed for furniture for a lot of the habitats inside the zoo. So the one tree is right in the center. It's called the Savannah Woodlands area, and it's a large ficus microcarpa. And okay. So that was the one tree we kept in place. And if you do go and see it, you'll recognize why we kept it in place.
It's majestic.
But it was a tricky thing to do, because obviously with contractors, and when you have hot summer days, first place that contractors want to hang out is under a tree where the shade is. So we had to put sort of parameters to the tree so that they couldn't go within those zones, so it wouldn't impact the tree.
Now that tree under the... under the screening, under the aviary, or
no, it's just to the east of that.
Okay,
it stands alone.
Correct.
Okay, I'll have to take another look at that the next time I'm out there.
And what else? What other unique things are in
moringas?
There?
I think another plant that's from both Africa and Madagascar. That was the first time for us to have any moringas. Dahlonix. So a lot of these plants are what they call caducifer trees, not your traditional dicot. Sort of has a more of a fibrous type of a trunk to them, but very water thrifty. Also can store a lot of energy, source very similar to the baobab.
Can you explain a dicot for folks, since you just said that?
Well, a dicot meaning a tree that has the woody tissue and the cambium layers, correct? Versus something that's like a monocot, like the palm and grass.
So herbaceous of some sort.
Herbaceous, right. Correct.
Now you mentioned Dahlonix. That's the same family that... Dahlonix regia.
Royal Poinciana.
Yes. You know, do you have? Is
so we do have that one, but that's a very tropical one in nature, and it's a little harder to grow.
It's very hard to grow. Yeah, we've had them periodically. We've never had them here in Poway, but we've had them periodically in our San Diego store. And as I recall, when we've had specimens down there, we can keep them going for about 7 or 8 years, and then they just it even in San Diego it's just not tropical.
It's
enough
too cold.
Yeah.
I think it definitely needs special attention, and I think the thing that we've found how to grow it, and there is a few in San Diego, the old parts of San Diego, where they grow them surrounded in concrete and asphalt in a raised planter, and they even will flower there. So there's been a few places in San Diego where that exists.
Do you think
that radiant heat from the night?
Radiant heat, correct. Yeah. From what I hear, they like to have temperatures at 80 degrees or above constantly. Yeah. So we just don't have that, especially ground temperatures.
No, I know. Well, pretty much every subtropical place that I've ever been to has them. I know that they're pretty prevalent in the Hawaiian Islands. They're all over Key West, down in the Keys. You see them around. It is a spectacular tree.
It
is absolutely spectacular tree. It's one of my favorite tropical trees. You know, you talk about the radiant heat. His name escapes me now, but he was a local landscape architect, and he was a huge fan of, he lives in La Jolla, is a huge fan of coconut palms. And he couldn't, he was trying to figure out why coconut palms would not grow in San Diego. Because when you look at where they grow, the salt doesn't seem to be, salt water doesn't seem to be a problem with them. So growing, and you know, and if you have good drainage, the only thing that he could think of was that was the soil temperature. But even in, you know, even in like Florida, where you'll, especially Florida, where you'll have coconut palms growing in areas where it gets cold, but it doesn't get cold for a long period of time. And that was, he figured that was probably the problem. So he built raised planters at his house and then put plexiglass over the top of them to keep the soil warm and keep the root system warmer. And he had pretty good success with them. I don't think they were, they weren't growing like they do in Hawaii, but I think that was the key to it, is keeping the root system warm. The rest of the plant is fine. Sure. You're not going to have any problems with it, but you got to keep those roots warm. Otherwise it's just not going to make it. So, which is unfortunate, because I love coconut palms. I think they're
I know that seems to be the question I get asked the most about, do we have any coconut palms at the zoo? And at one point we had a few in the reptile mesa because of the radiated heating. But like you said, those conditions have to be pretty good, and you have to keep them consistent.
Yeah.
Otherwise, eventually they will fail.
Yeah, they will. You're listening to Garden Talk here in KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Kane Anderson along with George Ullman and our special guest, Mike Letzring from the San Diego Zoo. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Ullman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Ullman and our special guest, Mike Letzring, horticulturalist from the San Diego Zoo. And we've been talking about the Africa rock exhibit up at the zoo. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend going over and taking a look at it. It was one of our former employees, Dario, works there. And he took, it's been a few years ago now, but he took my dad and I on a tour shortly after it opened. I think you were there too.
Yes.
So that was very nice and very interesting. I remember one of the things that blew me away was you were telling us how much of that kind of peach colored gravel that you covers big areas over there.
Oh yes. Well, you know, that Mojave gold is what they call it.
Yes. Yeah. And how much of that did you guys put down? You had told me it was an astonishing number.
So I have to admit, one of the things that's one of my weaknesses is remembering numbers. I can remember plant names with these mostly, but when it comes to numbers, but I know that
it was just a lot.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
And then I remember, is it the baboon exhibit that's in Africa Rocks?
Correct. Yes.
And I remember we were looking, because it was pretty shortly after it opened, and we were looking in the exhibit, and there were these little 8-inch potholes all over in one section of the baboon exhibit.
They might
exhibit.
Have been groundhogs or something, right? Well, or prairie dogs.
Actually, I think it was a species of grass that had been planted, right. And when they put the baboons in, they hadn't gotten established, and the baboons went and ripped them all out.
Yeah. You know, we live and learn.
But that's what it looked like. It looked like there were holes from, you know, prairie dogs or something.
Or meerkats or
exactly.
whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can remember exactly the number of grasses we placed there. It was about 3,000 grasses the gelatas and the baboon habitat. And literally almost every one of them, they pulled out to see what the root ball looked like.
Well, maybe they were learning and they were curious. So there are a lot of plants in there that we touched on a few of them, but there are a lot of filler plants too, you know, things that are just kind of shrub-like throughout. Like I know there's some Gardenia thumbergias and different leucodendrons and stuff. What are some others? What are some plants there that people could replicate in their yard that would be low water, but still pretty and not that deserty look?
Yes. Well, I you mentioned Dario, and Dario takes care of the Fimbos area of the Africa Rocks Project. That's where our penguins are. And in that area, we have a number of ericas, which we got from your nursery.
Mm-hmm.
We also got a number of proteas. And so the leucospermums, the leucodendrons, we have those growing there. Now, as much as I know a lot of people ask for them and they look great when they're flowering, I think we're coming up close to that flowering cycle this time of year. They are a little bit more work. I think the important part is having drainage and then phosphorus being the thing you do not add to the soil.
Yeah, we just did a class with John Clements, a very popular class on Proteaceae, and the two things that are always touted at the beginning of the class, the middle of the class, and at the end of the class is don't give it phosphorus and make sure the water drains well. Those are the two things that will keep them. He also said that I believe Nan Sturman calls most of the proteas 50% plants, because if you buy 10, you and if you don't meet those requirements, you end up with five.
So I think that's what I'm probably about 50% successful with proteas in my yard. Actually, it was the Banksias that I had issue with. The pincushion that I put in has grown like gangbusters, and then right next to it is a king protea, which is my favorite of the proteas. That's a South African protea, I believe.
Yes,
is it not?
Yeah,
and that it's just not as vigorous as the pincushions. The pincushion just grows like crazy.
Leucosperma, yeah, very right. easy. So what else? What are other plants that are
well? Obviously, gardenias, the gardenia thunbergia. We also have another species that that's similar to the thunbergia that also comes from that part of Africa that has a larger flower and a larger seed pod. I don't know if you've seen the seed pods on those gardenias.
Yeah.
Yes, the thunbergia is like a golf ball size, and just imagine the other one, which is Volksinae, is the species that I'm talking about. It has like a softball size fruit on.
Wow. I don't remember seeing that one when I was there the last time.
I'll have to look more closely.
I'll have to look that one up. You know, that's one thing that my grandfather grew a lot of gardenia thunbergias. That was one of his favorite plants, and he had a huge one in his yard, at his house in Bay Park. And we used to harvest the seed pods off of it, and we would grow them from seed. But when you grow them from seed, I remember him telling me it took several years for them to bloom. But if you grafted them, they would bloom faster. So we used to graft, that was what I did in high school, is grafted thousands and thousands of those things in 1 gallon containers, and they would bloom faster. And the foliage flattens out a little bit more too, for some reason. It's not when the seedlings are pretty crinkly. But he had told me that he had tried on a number of occasions, and he could grow just about anything. But he could never grow gardenia thunbergia from cuttings. And I don't know if you guys have ever tried to do that.
We tried doing that, and I've been like 50% successful with
that. Okay, you're more successful than we were, because we were pretty much at 0% successful trying to do it.
Yeah. Well, another interesting story with the gardenia, since you brought it up, is at our condor habitat at Elephant Odyssey, we have a fairly mature gardenia thunbergia in there. And a number of years ago, this was before Africa Rocks, we remember seeing all this little green seedlings coming up underneath it. But, you know, as you know, the fruit is like rock hard.
Oh, yeah.
Very difficult to get into, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're trying to figure out, well, who broke into that? Well, we believe it was the condor who broke into it with their beaks. And then those seedlings germinated. So we got permission to go inside and dig out those seedlings and basically planted them up in the nursery. I had a total of like 27 of them. And literally through the 8.5 acres of Africa Rocks, you'll find them from top to bottom. Those seedlings that turned into plants that were assistedly propagated by the condors.
That is amazing, because how we used to crack the seed pods open on the thunbergias when we would get them is we had a huge vise in the workshop at the nursery, and we'd take them in and put them in lengthwise, or put them in end to end in the vise jaws, and just crank the vise down. Because they're really, really, it's one of the most difficult seed pods to crack that I have ever seen. It's incredible how tough those things are. And we would pull the seeds out and plant them, and they grow fairly easy from seed. But that just amazes me that a condor, even though it's a big bird, could crack one of those seed pods open.
Well, when you think about what they eat and how they get into it, maybe that's why you have extra strong beaks and constant pounding.
Yeah, but correct me if I'm wrong, but condors typically feed off of carrion too, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. Just thinking, so, like getting between bone matter and stuff.
But I wonder what made them go after
that's a fair point. Unless it looked like something,
Very, very interesting. Now, does the gardenia volksiana, does it look like a gardenia thunbergia?
For sure. Yes.
And it's a big single flower?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay.
It's just the flower is about the size of my hand, so about 4 or 5 inches in diameter.
Wow. That's interesting. I'll have to take a look.
And the shrub grows a lot larger than regular Thunbergia.
Wait, is there?
I wonder if that's what my grandfather had in his backyard. I always thought it was Thunbergia, but it was probably about, I want to say it was probably about 15 feet or so tall, and fully foliated all the way down to the bottom. And it did have big single flowers on it, and the seed pods were probably maybe 3 or 4 inches long. Yeah. I wonder if it was Volxiana that he had.
Very possible.
Maybe so. But, you know, because you're an expert in this stuff, just flows off your tongue, and we just, you know, throw out Gardenia, Thunbergia, and all the others. Common names for folks that may not know what I know it just as like the white gardenia or the forest gardenia. Yeah.
Well, common names, you know, as you know.
Oh, I know.
Depend on where you live. But
if someone's here and saying, I wonder which one he's talking about.
We call it the African gardenia.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
that's
the one with the flower that's about 5 inches in diameter.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also the rootstock for all the grafted gardenias that you buy in stores right now.
And we have two of them at the Poway store, right out front.
I think they've. That's right, yeah. And those actually
they didn't start out that way.
They started out as grafted gardenias, and now they are Gardenia thunbergia. That was
we have one at our house just beyond our rose garden. So it's still a youngster, but looking forward to it.
You have to. If you get the grafted gardenias, you really have to watch out for suckers on them, because the suckers will take over. And if you don't catch it soon enough, you'll end up with a Gardenia thunbergia instead of a mystery.
I think it's a handsome plant by itself.
It's a pretty plant.
It's not the same gardenia flower, you know, but I think it's a beautiful plant. The leaves are spectacular when it's
even the branch work with that silver bark on them.
Yeah. It's a good looking plant.
It's a very good looking plant.
What other plants could I walk down there and take home? Not with a cutting, because that would be illegal, but yeah. You know.
Well, if you go into the Madagascar hub area, we have a number of Operculicarias pachypus. So that, or not pachypus, but Dicariae. They call that the Jabili tree. It's in the mango family. They use it often in the collections for bonsai, but it's a very easy one to grow. So that is basically our marker of the Madagascar section. We have a number of aloes, Aloe Susanae, which is also from Madagascar. We have Alawadias, the acatillos from Madagascar.
I've seen those.
Yeah, that's a neat plant.
I remember that.
I love acatillos, but I think the Alawadias are, it's actually I think it's a prettier plant. And it was about a year ago, we were driving somewhere here in San Diego, and somebody had a specimen sized one in their front yard, and it was actually in bloom. And I had never seen one in bloom before. And it's a pretty spectacular plant when it's in bloom. I think the flower kind of a whitish, creamish flower on it.
Yes, it is.
But I'd never seen that before. And the other interesting thing about it too is the foliage turns in between daylight and evening. I can't remember which direction it turns, but
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. Another interesting fact with the Alawadia is they're one of the few plants that actually grow into the wind. They call it anemotropism. Where
I have
a lot
not
of plants
heard of that
grow
before.
Away from the wind. In this case, the plant will grow into the wind.
What do they know what the reason is for that? Or?
No, I haven't heard. I just something I read.
Oh. Well,
and I'm witnessing ours now because I can tell where our prevailing wind comes from. And so you can see that
it
that's
leans
the direction.
Into it.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Now we have so much more to look for when I get down there again.
Yeah. I remember my dad had told me one time there's a particular variety of Araucaria. I can't remember which one it is, but it never grows straight. And I can't remember if it grows into the prevailing wind, it grows into the wind or which, but you never find one with a straight trunk because they're always curved.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'll have to ask him which one that was, see if he remembers, but yeah, the Africa rock section of the zoo is just an amazing, amazing accomplishment. For what they've done over there, and it's well worth it.
Absolutely. It's also a great way to traverse the zoo from, you know, one of the upper spots to get down to the other side.
To the other
it works
side.
Really well.
Yeah. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We're talking with Mike Letzring, horticulturalist from the San Diego Zoo. We're going to take a quick break and we're back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Oh. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We're talking to our special guest, Mike Letzring from the San Diego Zoo. He's a horticulturalist there, and he's been telling us all kinds of stuff about the zoo and the plants there and the Africa Rocks exhibit, which we highly recommend going to see. You also do a lot with edible fruit or fruit trees.
But before we get there, may I ask one quick question? Just because in Africa Rocks, you once gave me a tour.
That's right.
Yeah. And at the very kind of towards the bottom where the big waterfall is, the mists of the waterfall, there's a large leafed lobelia.
Yes.
And I always think of those as the little tiny bedding things that you put around rocks. And so what is that plant and what's unique about it?
Yes, that plant is the Lobelia bonanensis from the Bonin Islands, which is part of, I think, off the islands off the coast of Japan. That island was obviously hit really hard during World War II, and so a lot of those plants are endangered. We received that as seed from Waimea Valley, so that's part of that resource sharing program that we've done with Waimea all these years. So that's how we were able to attain that plant into our collection.
It's completely different.
I mean, right?
The big leaf on it.
Oh, for sure. If you look at it, you almost go back into that prehistoric time with dinosaurs and things like that because of its look. The flower, when it does flower, is this long spike with just hundreds and hundreds of flowers, sort of a creamy white color.
Yeah, I have to point that out to people when we walk through there.
Yeah, there's another.
It's so unique.
Yeah, lobelia is not just a little border blue ground cover plant. There's a marginal water plant that's a lobelia, and is it Lobelia cardinalis? That's a very upright, has kind of reddish foliage to it. It's been a while since I've seen one, but there's a lot more to the lobelia than ones that you plant a.
Well, you know, you were talking
pathway.
Was it last week when we were doing the show? You talked about the top 40 mm-hmm. about plants, and you know, people get, and myself included, sometimes you just get caught up in the more popular plants and you don't realize that there's so much more in the same genus. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's a good example of it right there.
I'll
cut you off on that. I was just curious of that before we left to get to the fruit trees.
Yeah. I'll have to go look for that one now. Something to go explore.
Yeah. Now you have a reason to go.
Another reason to
go to the zoo.
Yeah. Exactly. Another interesting fact about that plant. So having that waterfall, we obviously get a mist that falls off of that and we have to treat the water with bleach. So you'll get a kind of a mist that comes off of that. Mm-hmm. So trying to find plants that can tolerate that bleach mist, mm-hmm. that is one because of the waxiness that it has on its leaf. So like Ligularia, they have that ability as well. And then mm-hmm. same with this Lobelia.
So Ken, you're asking him about tropical fruit trees. Mike has taught, two or three years now in a row in the summer. You teach a class for us on tropical fruit.
Yes.
And I know that you enjoy that as well. And you're the banana guy at the zoo, right? Is that a correct?
Banana guy.
Correct.
It's funny. Moniker. I get people to ask me, what is my favorite or do I have a favorite plant? I think I don't anymore. I mean, when I first started, it was cycads and palms. But since I've been at the zoo with that vast collection, I really enjoyed bananas. In 1998, when I pretty much a year or two after our horticulturist Charles Colburn, he introduced the bananas into this one section of the zoo. And so basically I've been trying to take care of them ever since. There's like 22 different varieties of bananas. Most of them are the table bananas, the kind that you would find in the grocery store. And then there's some plantains as well.
You don't see them as often as you used to a number of years ago, but Abyssinian bananas were very popular at one time for large landscape plants. They come in a red and a green form. And an Abyssinian banana is an ornamental banana. They will flower, but they don't
set fruit.
Fruit. But one of the drawbacks to them too is I don't believe they pup. So once they flower, bananas are terminal flowering in that when they flower, that's the end of them. They will decline and eventually die. But they used to be pretty popular, and it was a spectacular plant in a full grown one in a landscape. But once that flower comes out, it's done. Although I can't remember who it was, but there was somebody in the industry that I was talking to, we were talking to about it. And one of the things that they were going to try to do to prevent it from flowering, because the flower stalk comes up through the center of the plant, was that they ran a pitchfork through the trunk to try to suppress the flower from coming up. I don't know if it was successful or not. And that's a waste of a pitchfork too. So you don't get to use that if you're going to try that. But we see them pop, they pop up every once in a while, but not anything like they used to.
We have a lot of folks that do grow bananas here in the, I see it in the San Diego Gardener Facebook page and such. And
well, and there was a banana nursery up in Ventura, I think it was in Camarillo. It was right near the coast.
That's right.
And we used to get a lot of root divisions from them, and we would can them up. I remember when dating myself going back a long ways now, about the only fruiting banana that we would ever get was the dwarf Cavendish banana, which is a nice smaller, if you don't have a big place for a banana, that was a really good one. And they produced well and had a decent fruit on it. But now there's a lot more bananas that are out there now when we can find them. And we do try to bring them in the summertime. It's a little cold up here in the wintertime for them. San Diego store, it's not as bad, but up here it's a little cold for them. But
yeah,
some neat plants, really neat. Bananas are a neat tropical looking plant. I do like them.
What are some of the other more common tropical plants tropical fruit that we can grow here?
Well, we have a number of cherimoyas and atamoyas, starfruit. We also have different types of sapote. Also some Brazilian cherries, or so your tropical cherries, right. Jabuticabas, which is also a really nice one.
That's an interesting piece of fruit, the way it grows on a tree, right?
Yeah,
that's the one that grows on the trunk.
Correct.
Yeah, John was telling me they had one out at Quail, and I think that's where the San Diego Botanical Garden. The San Diego Botanical Garden
again. Yeah.
They had one out there, and that was where I saw it. But I had just seen an article about it not too long ago. It is a very interesting plant.
Now you've brought some when you've taught. You've brought some in for people to taste too. Yeah.
Yeah, I have some at my house, and then obviously we have them at the zoo as well. And we can get about 3 harvests a year.
Downside is it takes a long time to fruit from seed, right?
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately, the tree is slow growing.
Yeah.
So you do have to find one already of size. I mean, other than that, it's just making sure it gets plenty of water, like almost just about any plant. If you want it to look like anything's mature, you'd have to give it plenty of water.
Right. Mangoes.
You talk about
mangoes a lot too.
Yeah, so we do have a number of mangoes. We have one of our horticulturists, Patrick. He is really involved with mangoes. So he just mentioned a new mango that we have in our collection now. It's called Winter. And it sort of has a whitish color to it when the fruit is ripe. So I don't know a whole lot about that. But yes, mangoes are fun. The only thing is they don't really become trees here. And maybe that's a good thing because of the cold suppression. It kind of holds them back. So they become like large shrubs. This way, it is a lot easier to harvest.
Right, because a mango tree, and I remember playing golf in the Philippines, and one of the tee boxes was under a mango, and it was massive.
Oh, they get big.
Huge.
I think mango is a beautiful subtropical tree. I mean, just gorgeous, glossy green foliage, and then the new foliage comes out with that bronzish color to them. A long time ago, I'll have to go down and see if it's still there, but down on National Avenue, down in Logan Heights, between two little houses, there's not very many residential units on National Avenue these days. It's mostly industrial, but there was one section where there were some houses. It was just north of the bridge. There was a massive, massive mango tree growing between the two houses. It was way taller than the houses, and it was just loaded with fruit. It was the biggest mango I've seen on the mainland.
At least in Southern California, allowed it to grow so
big.
It
could be, but yeah, it's I like the ornament. I like the ornamental value of mangoes more than I do.
You don't like the fruit?
I don't like the fruit.
Oh, we love it.
I don't like the fruit. I have tried it all over the Pacific, and I cannot find one that I like.
We even like dried mangoes, but I love mangoes. Capri calls them mango whenever we buy them in the store. You know, yeah, there's some mango.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good stuff.
Yeah, that's just what I can eat it, but it's not something that I go out of my way to find. You know, another interesting and rare fruit. We've had them in the past, but I haven't seen very many of them at all over time. Is lychees. You know, have you been successful growing lychees here, or have you tried them?
Yes. So we do have a couple lychee trees in the zoo. I've planted them over 20 years ago. to this day, I'm still waiting for more than a handful of fruit. So I think what I've learned, and this is in from Hawaii, some of the experts over there with lychee, is that you almost, they have to have a certain amount of humidity. Unfortunately, in San Diego, our humidity is only greater in the summer months.
Mm-hmm.
And the humidity level that they like to have in order for when they're in that flowering cycle to get to a maturity is just a little what we don't have.
Beyond our reach, yeah.
Yes. So we can pick certain locations and we have a little bit more humidity, but it's still not as well as it is in Hawaii.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. That's another one that's not on my
list. It's not your list?
Not on, on my list.
Something that you have, and I don't know if you can, I guess you'd have to consider it a tropical, is the Kai apple. You have a lot of those around the gardens, both at the safari park and the zoo.
I'm not familiar with that.
We have a bunch of them. They're relegated at our yard to the other section with all the thorns because they have thorns, you know, this big as my arms are stretched out. That's a little exaggeration, but I like the fruit. It's good. Yeah,
it's just working for it to get it is the hard part because, like you said, the spines are about 3 inches long.
But it's a very, very drought-tolerant plant. Does very well. And I know that in Africa, they actually use the branches. They cut them and use them to make brambles and stuff to keep animals out.
They do with the acacias.
It's just, exactly.
It's just thorn trees.
That was a tree often used inside habitats in the zoo many years ago before Elephant Odyssey. And use them inside because they knew the animals would leave them alone.
Well, I certainly do.
One of the other plants that I remember seeing around the zoo a lot, and you would see it planted along the railings overlooking enclosures, was carissas, grandiflora.
Yeah, natal plums.
Yeah, there was a lot of those I remember. I don't know if they're still there or not, but I have a feeling it was probably the same for the same reason that you plant them along the edge of the enclosure and it keeps the people out of the enclosure.
Right, right. I think we obviously are trying to minimize the labor that goes in trimming hedges right between the habitats. So we've kind of reduced the number of them. Also the fruit is tasty, but it's also easy for guests to get to. Mm-hmm. And then the next, you know what, they throw it inside the habitat.
So
you
try to minimize that type of thing too.
You can't have that go on.
But that's a nice plant too. That's very fragrant when that's in bloom. I like that a lot.
Yeah. My grandparents had some growing out their back door, their kitchen. It was a fond memory of that. We've been talking to Mike Letzring here on Garden Talk. And Mike, thank you very much for coming in. We really appreciate it. It's a very interesting talk and telling us about everything that's going on up at the zoo. Highly recommend that if you haven't been lately, go check it out and definitely check out Africa Rocks. It's a fantastic part of the zoo. Hopefully you'll join us again at some point in time. And,
I was going to say, and keep an eye on our calendar because he'll probably be teaching a tropical fruit tree class this summer. He just doesn't know it yet.
Yeah. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We'll be back with another hour next week. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.